Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So this is an interesting topic with lots to talk about. I haven't given it before, so I think there's a lot of material. I might go through some of it quickly to make sure I get important stuff in. But there are kind of two sections. One is sort of what's the contemporary general landscape, and then the second is what does St. Thomas Aquinas kind of say about it. So the first in the general landscape is there are three views that are out there, generally speaking: determinism, compatibilism, and libertarianism. The last sometimes called the agency view as well. So you define these views. Determinism says we are determined and we are not free. So all these, you're answering two questions: are we determined and are we free? So determinism says, yes, we are determined and we're not free. Compatibilism says we are determined and we are free. So the first says we're determined but not free. Compatibilism says we are determined but also free. Libertarianism says that at least in some actions we are not determined, and in those actions we are free. So we're going to look at each of these in a little bit more detail. So again, what is determinism? Well, it says in all of our actions, we are determined, right? Just as rocks are determined in their behavior, billiard balls on a billiard table are determined in their behavior, so too are human beings determined. In particular, we are determined by heredity and environment, okay? So heredity means there's something inborn in us that sets certain dispositions. Environment means our training has shaped us in such a way that we will act. So you might think that you freely chose to come here tonight, but in fact, according to determinism, you were born with certain makeup, you had a certain upbringing, all these things came together such that you had to come here tonight, such as determinism. So there are various arguments that are given in favor of determinism. Probably the most common of these is could be called the nature of causes. The idea here is everything needs a cause, and then they identify causes as necessarily determined to some effect. So if you say everything needs a cause, that means human actions need a cause, such as your action of coming here tonight. And whatever causes your action is determined to some particular effect. To speak of actions as free in their mind is to speak of them as uncaused and therefore as nonsensical and as, in fact, random and having nothing to do with us. So it makes more sense to call our actions caused, but as soon as we call them caused, we're calling them determined. The second argument here is based upon prediction. The idea here is that we can predict what other people will do. You may have predicted that a certain friend would come here tonight, for instance, would be a possibility, right? Or you might predict what somebody will say about a certain movie or something like that. So we can predict what other people do, but the argument goes, in order to make predictions, we need knowledge of necessary causes. Because we know the future by first of all knowing the present conditions, and then in knowing the present conditions, we know the causes that are operative, and then we project into the future. So we do this for heavenly bodies all the time. We can predict where Mars will be at this time next year. Why? Because we know the current conditions, we know the laws of gravity, necessary causes acting in certain ways. But imagine if Mars were free and it could decide to slow down on one day, it's a little bit tired, you know, and so Well, then we couldn't predict where Mars would be next year, right? So the only way we can predict is because Mars acts according to certain necessary laws. So if we predict human behavior, then the determinist claim, human beings must be acting according to certain necessary laws. The third one is based upon the fact that we punish people, we exhort them to behave in certain ways, and so on. And the idea behind this is that these things are useful only insofar as they affect or change people's behavior, right? So you punish your child, you punish your son for beating up his sister because you think, well, in the future then he won't beat up his sister, right? So we punish criminals so that they won't steal cars anymore and so on. Or we exhort people, we'll tell people, you really shouldn't do that because we plan on changing how they're going to behave. But if these things act as causes upon how people behave, well, then human action need a cause. So in a way, this last one brings us back to the first one on the natures of the causes, right? So what is compatibilism? Compatibilism is the view that we are free but are determined. Now, to be clear on this one, it means that in the very same action in which you're determined, you're also free. So some people would confuse this with saying, well, I have some free actions and I have some determined actions, okay? That's not what this view is saying. It's saying all of your actions are determined, so it's agreeing wholeheartedly with determinism there. But determinism answered the other question, are we free, by saying, no, we're not free. That's nonsense. That would be an uncaused action. Well, compatibilism says the very same actions in which you are determined, some of those are also free. So you were determined to come here tonight, but you freely chose here to come here tonight. Now, on the face of it, a lot of people think this makes no sense at all. But ultimately, it comes down to how you define free will. So the denial of free will, they say, arises from a misunderstanding that some people suppose that free actions equals undetermined or uncaused actions. And we saw that the determinist said that, well, free actions, that's an uncaused action, and that's just nonsense. Well, the compatibilist says, no, that's not what we mean by free action. We mean by a free action one that arises from within, from your own internal beliefs and desires, whereas an unfree action arises from outside. So if somebody dragged you here tonight, well, that was unfree because that arose from the outside. Somebody was dragging you. But if you had certain beliefs that you wanted to find out about free will and you had a desire to fulfill that, then you came here of your own free will. It doesn't mean you weren't determined. You were still determined by heredity and environment, just like the determinists say, but it's free because it arises from within. So what are the arguments in favor of compatibilism? The arguments in favor of the determinist aspect are the exact same as the argument for the determinism. But so now we get to questions of what about freedom? Well, the first is the argument for moral responsibility. They say that moral responsibility would make no sense if we were not free. But we are morally responsible for what we do, so therefore we are free. The second has to do with the definition of a free act, which we've already briefly mentioned. They will take common examples of what we call a free action and what we call an unfree action. So again, if you were dragged here tonight, we'd all say that was unfree action, right? But we say of that because you came because of your own beliefs and desires, we call that a free action, right? So ultimately, they say the problem with determinists is this: they have a bad definition of a free action, right? As soon as we get a good definition of a free action, we realize that at least some of our determined actions are also free actions. Libertarianism, or also called the agency view. I thought I had a discussion here on could have done otherwise, but it must be coming up later. All right, so libertarian view, also called the agency view. What is this view? It says we are free and not determined. Now again, It means that in the free actions that we have, we aren't determined. If you were dragged here tonight, well, then maybe you were determined to come here, right? But in your free actions, if you freely chose to come here, you were not determined to do so. So the compatibilist would say, yeah, you freely came here, but also you were determined. The libertarian would say, yes, if you came here freely, then it was not a determined action. The free action, then, is not an undetermined or uncaused action. So they agree with the compatibilist that that's a bad definition of a free action. But free actions are self-determined actions. So they say, basically, both of the other two views get a bad definition of a free act. So the determinists say a free act is an undetermined or uncaused action. The compatibilists say as long as it arises from within, even though it's determined, that's free. The libertarian says, well, no, it does have to arise from within. The compatibilists get that much right. It does have to arise from within. But more than that, it has to arise from within and be a self-determined action, right? So that ultimately you are determining for yourself that you came here tonight, not your heredity environment. They may have influenced your behavior, right? But ultimately you made the determination to come here rather than your heredity and environment. So once we get that notion of a free action, both of the other two views are going to deny that there is any such thing. And the libertarian says that's precisely what is distinctive of free action. Well, a lot of the defense of the agency view is arguments against the other views. So I'm going to look fairly quickly at arguments concerning that we've seen already and see what they say in response. So the determinists said, remember, that by the very nature of a cause, everything needs a cause, and the very nature of a cause is such that it will be determined to some effect. But the libertarian will argue not every cause is necessarily determined to all of their effects. What's essential to a cause is not determinately necessarily bringing something about. What's essential is dependence. The effect depends upon the cause, right? So, example going big picture metaphysics would be, if God creates the universe, what's essential to his being a cause? That he was determined to bring about the universe? No, that the universe depends upon him for its existence, right? So you could have a cause that isn't necessarily determined. Many causes are determined to some particular effect. The libertarian isn't denying that, but saying that's not the definition of a cause. The definition of a cause has to do with the effect depending upon it. How about prediction of human actions? Remember, this was, we predict only if we know that we have some necessary causes that we project into the future. The libertarian says that absolutely certain and precise predictions do require necessary causes. Heavenly body predictions such as where Mars will be next year get pretty close to being absolutely certain and precise, but actually they aren't, because there could be a body we don't know about that comes into the solar system and dislodges Mars somewhat from its path. So we don't have absolutely certain and precise predictions, but we do have pretty close to that. But the important thing is that fairly certain and rough predictions, which is most of the predictions we make, and certainly the predictions we make for human behavior, require only what might be called a tendency for behavior. So it is the case that even if we are free, we still might have certain tendencies to behave in certain ways. So some people might have an angry disposition, other people might have a calm disposition, some people might be very organized, other people not so organized. We're all familiar with these sort of tendencies that people have. And these tendencies allow us to make fairly certain and rough predictions about what people will do. But we all know from experience that we're all not always right in these predictions that we make of others, because they are only fairly certain and rough predictions. So ultimately, we don't need necessary causes. We need only these tendencies. This was the compatibilist argument for responsibility. Says that we are responsible for actions that we ourselves control, not what the compatibilists say, simply arising from within. There are typical examples that they give with regard to this, to say that not everything that arises from within is free. So some of them get kind of wild and science fiction-y, but suppose, let's just go with a little mild example, that somebody hypnotized you to come to class today. Right? So somebody hypnotized, or not class, but whatever the heck this is, to Mystic Institute lecture. Somebody hypnotized you to come to this lecture tonight, right? So you might say, well, it's not free because I was hypnotized. But the compatibilists can say, well, but it arose from your internal beliefs and desires. The libertarian says, well, yeah, but those internal beliefs and desires were not self-determined. They were determined by the hypnotist. And what makes an action to be free and responsible is if it's self-determined. So you wouldn't be responsible if, in fact, you were brainwashed or, people put chips in brains. There are all these science fiction things that come up in these sorts of examples. So ultimately, the argument goes, responsibility is not sufficiently explained by compatibilism. Together with this goes an idea of you could have done otherwise. So it's a fairly universal intuition that you're responsible for something if you could have done otherwise. So if, you kill Will, so... If you kill Will and you couldn't have done otherwise, right, there's nothing else you could do, we think to ourselves, well, then you're not quite responsible. But according to compatibilists, there is nothing else that you could do because you're determined, right? So there's this intuition that you're responsible only if you could have done otherwise. If you look at compatibilism, it seems as if we're determined, and so we cannot do otherwise, right? So ultimately, this is an argument against the compatibilist responsibility. We're responsible if we could have done otherwise. Compatibilism not allow for doing otherwise, and so we are determined. Now, there's a standard compatibilist response to this, which says, if you had desired otherwise, then you would have done otherwise, okay? So if you had desired otherwise, then you would have done otherwise. So yes, you desired to kill Will, and you killed Will, okay? And you were determined to kill Will. But could you have done otherwise? Well, the compatibilist says, well, yeah, if you had desired otherwise, then not only could you have done otherwise, you would have done otherwise. So that's a standard compatibilist response to this objection. But the libertarian has a response to that. Sure, if you had desired otherwise, then you would have done otherwise, but you could not have desired otherwise because your desires were shaped by hereditary environment. So you get this kind of conditional, if you had desired otherwise, then you have done otherwise. And that's kind of like saying, well, if the moon were made of cheese, then it might make for a good meal. That's a true statement, I suppose, right? If the moon were made of cheese, then it might make for a good meal. But a true statement is pretty useless if the first part of the if statement is false and can possibly be true. It's false that the moon is made of cheese, so it doesn't matter that the combination, if the moon were made of cheese, it would make for a good meal. That's true, but that doesn't matter. So too, if you had desired otherwise, then you would have done otherwise. But that doesn't matter because you couldn't desire otherwise as far as compatibilism is concerned, right? So these are some positive, this is some positive argument now in favor of agency view. Previously we had the arguments against what the others had said. So the arguments for self-determinism, the most common has to do with common experience. And so we commonly experience deliberating about what to do, and we commonly experience making choices and this being up to us, and that being a self-determinist. So it's not like it's saying this is an absolute conclusive argument. It's just saying, look, we all have a common experience of making choices, and when we do, we have a sense that it's up to us. The determinist will respond by saying, well, that's all an illusion. It just feels like it's up to us. It feels like it's up to you. And if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about these experiments that Benjamin Libet did. But so they say it's an illusion. And the libertarian will say, look, the best explanation of this experience is that, in fact, we are free. Another argument has to do with the variability of human behavior. The idea being here that if you look at billiard balls, the way billiard balls behave is pretty patterned, pretty straightforward. You know, there's variety in them, but it's pretty predictable. If you moved up from billiard balls to, say, cockroaches, there's a little bit more variety in the behavior of cockroaches, but they're actually pretty predictable. You know, if you walk into the room and they scurry away, evidently they sense the air movement of you coming into the room. They can get fairly good predictions about how they behave. Their behavior is not all that varied, and it comes down. You might think so as you're trying to stomp on them, perhaps, but it's not all that varied. You move up in the animal kingdom to something like, you know, a squirrel, and its behavior is a lot more varied than the cockroach, and so it goes as you move up. But the idea here is that when you get to human beings, the variety of behavior is just absolutely astonishing. It's beyond anything we find in the animal kingdom. And we're looking at the animal kingdom in the wide, not trained animals, because domestically trained animals have variety of behavior that plays off the fact that we are training them to have different behavior, right? So if you look at them in the wild versus human beings, we see this great variety in human beings. And again, the best explanation here seems to be that ultimately we do, in fact, have free will. So I'm going to talk a little bit about these Benjamin Libet experiments, but I want to get onto Aquinas here. But so when determinists say that free will is an illusion, you know, we all experience making free decisions, but ultimately they aren't free. They refer oftentimes to these experiments by Benjamin Libet, in which he measured three things: the awareness of an urge or intention, the readiness potential, that's neural firing in the brain in a certain area, to move, and the actual movement. So what was involved here? So they told the person to clench their fist, basically. They said, when you feel the urge, clench your fist, okay? And they had a clever way of measuring the timing of when they felt the urge. Obviously, it was pretty straightforward to see when they clenched their fist, and they had them, with some sensors to measure the readiness potential. So ultimately, they had this order that you would expect if we're free. You're aware of the intention, there's a readiness potential, and then you actually move. What did Benjamin Libet find? He found that the first in this series was the readiness potential. Then there was the awareness of the intention to clench the fist, and then there was the actual movement. So ultimately, the first two are switched around, looking like, oh, it's just neural activity that comes into play, not some free intention. He did some follow-up research because he actually wanted to discover that human beings were free, and he was kind of surprised by his own thing. So he did some follow-up research in which he concluded that human beings don't have what he called positive freedom, but negative freedom. He said, once you feel that urge to clench your fist, then you can decide to resist it. Okay, and when he did that, yes, he found that the resisting came after the readiness potential and after the awareness. And so ultimately, he said, there's this veto power in the will. There are tons of objections raised against the Libet experiments. Can't possibly go into them. They were set up, the experiments were set up that the person had actually already made a decision. They decided ahead of time when they feel the urge, they're going to clench the fist. That's what they were told to do. So they actually weren't making decisions in the first one. In the second one, they were making a decision. Should I veto it, right? So in the second one, where he finds the right ordering of things, the person was making a decision. In the first experiment, they had already made a decision. When I feel an urge, I'm going to clench my fist. So that's a common objection that's raised against him. Let's see here. Let's go on to... just to be clear, two primary senses of a free action. External liberty means that you're not physically forced to do something. Internal freedom means that you make a determination for yourself. So we use the same word free act, right? So we might say we live in a free country, by which we might mean that we're not, you know, forced to do things, physically forced to do things, or thrown in prison without justification or something like that. That's external liberty. Internal freedom means that you can make choices and determinations on your own. External freedom is insufficient for there being free will, right? Animals have external freedom. Animals in the forest have external freedom. In the zoo, maybe they have limited external freedom. But the idea of human beings, not animals, self-determined, they have the internal freedom. All right, I want to look on to Aquinas. So this is the second section of the class, or not the class, whatever this is. Lecture, keep on saying that. So this second section, we're going to look at what Aquinas has to say about free will. So we've looked at sort of the landscape that's out there of different views of free will. So Aquinas actually identifies the will as a certain power that we have, and he talks of it as an appetite. So that first word up there, appetite, is an inherent movement towards some goal following upon knowledge. He's actually going to give two different kinds of appetites, emotions and will. So if, you know, you want pizza, for instance, Aquinas says this is an appetite you have, and it means that you're aware of pizza. You're aware of something good about pizza, the taste, presumably. Maybe nutritional value, something like that. But you're aware of some things good about pizza. Then you are moving towards that, right? So you're moving towards attaining the pizza. That's what an appetite is in general. And again, emotions are one kind. And animals have emotions. Animals get angry, they desire various things, they get sad, and so on. So they have awareness of things, and they have then movements towards things as a result of this awareness. And that's what the emotions are. And of course, we're animals, so we have emotions as well. Will is the second appetite, as far as Aquinas is concerned, and this is going to be found only in human beings. So we'll talk a little bit about a difference between them. So the two kinds, the emotions and the will, and they are distinguished by their object. The object of the emotions ultimately is what's pleasing to the senses, right? There can be other details involved there because he talks about irascible emotions that involve some difficulty. But so pleasing or displeasing to the senses is what one's looking at there. But the object for the will, he says, is the good universally considered. And the difference here is based upon what kind of knowledge these follow upon. So they're both appetites. An appetite is a movement towards something following upon knowledge. Emotions follow upon what he calls sense knowledge. But he has a kind of broader meaning of sense knowledge than we typically mean. The five external senses, yes, that's included, but also internal, what he calls internal senses, which are things like imagination, instinct, I think would be in that. He doesn't use that term too much, but he calls it an estimation. But he's talking about the same thing. This is sense knowledge. So the bird that, you know, decides to pick up a twig to help build its nest has a kind of sense knowledge that this is going to be helpful for the nest, something like that, and so has an emotional desire with regard to it. The will, in contrast, doesn't arise from sense knowledge, but what Aquinas calls reason. So this is something it found only in human beings. It gets beyond the senses to know the natures of things, to know the causes of things, to know things in a universal manner. And that includes knowing the good. So we can know the nature of the good. And very briefly, what is the nature of the good? Well, the nature of the good is what completes some thing, in particular, what completes something moving to an end. So we can talk about the good of an eye is to see well. A good knife is a sharp knife. Why? Because that completes a knife in its movement to an end. What's its movement to an end? To cut, right? So a doctor is a good doctor if he heals well, because what's the doctor moving to? What's the end of the doctor? To heal. And so that will make for a good doctor. So with our reason, not with the senses, but with our reason, we can understand this idea of a good universally considered, the nature of the good. And so this new kind of knowledge of the good is going to give rise to a new appetite, which is the will. So he talks about different acts of the will as he talks about different acts of the emotions. So in the emotions, for instance, he will talk about love, desire, and enjoyment for some basic goods, right? Love, desire, and enjoyment. If it's something bad, he has hate. And don't think, you know, love like Mother Teresa, love the poor or something. Think of, you know, I love chocolate ice cream or something like that, right? That's the sense that he's using it here, right? So love, desire, and enjoyment. For a bad thing, you have hate and aversion and then pain or sorrow if you kind of get stuck with it, right? So those are different kinds of emotions. He also talks about these emotions that deal with difficult things. So he will talk about hoping to attain something, despairing of attaining something. He will talk about fearing something, and about daring to face something, and anger. So those are different kinds of emotions. And what's interesting is he will say of the will that we could use the same words for what's going on there, but there are important differences, even if we're using the same words. So we might say, with the will, I desire pizza. With the emotions, I desire pizza, right? So we might use the same word there, but there are important differences. First important difference is that the emotions have a bodily component, right? So they have a bodily component. So we're all familiar with this. If you're, you know, afraid, your heart is beating fast and your muscles are tensing up, you can feel it. We call emotions feelings sometimes, right? You can feel it inside of you. It has this bodily change that's really part of what it means to have the emotion. And so it is with all emotions as far as Aquinas is concerned. He says the will, well, that's going to be an entirely immaterial, a spiritual power that ultimately doesn't have a bodily component to it. So it's not a feeling, as a result, we'll be aware of it, not by feeling it. We're aware of our emotions. We say, oh, get in touch with your feelings, I suppose, right? You can feel it, right? You're not going to feel your acts of will. You're just going to be your reason that's going to be aware of acts of will. Sometimes we kind of like to accept only what we can feel, And so people will say, yeah, I have emotions, but I don't know what you're talking about with acts of will, because I can't feel that, right? I can feel my fear, I can feel my anger, but I can't feel these acts of will. So some people will deny acts of will just because they're not something that's felt. But ultimately, some of the most profound things in our lives are things that we cannot feel. So you might want to take an experiment of go to your room by yourself, turn off all the lights, your cell phone, your computer, everything, at night, unless you're afraid of the dark, I suppose, and just sit there. 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour, hour, hour and a half. How long before you go crazy? We're uncomfortable being alone with ourselves. We want distractions, right? Phones are great for that, aren't they, right? We want distractions. We're uncomfortable being alone with ourselves because there is a deep dissatisfaction that's in the will. And the dissatisfaction, rather than try to overcome it, we just distract ourselves with the emotions. So ultimately, we put ourselves at risk by denying the will and looking only at the emotions. All right, we're going to look at the freedom of the will. So you can see Aquinas, well, sometimes think when today when we speak of the will, we just mean free will. Well, I started by saying for Aquinas, the will is an appetite. Just to get across to you, yeah, the will is free for Aquinas, but that's not the starting point. The will is much more than just a power that chooses, right? It has all these desires. It's seeking the good in general. But now we're going to turn our attention to the free will. And we're going to get at this by looking at Aristotle's four causes. There are two external causes and two internal causes. The two external causes are efficient cause, and that's what we usually mean by the word cause in English. This brings something about. So if you have fire and you heat water, fire is the efficient cause of the water getting hot, for instance. You have final cause, and that is the purpose or end of something. So if you think of a vase, and I will use this, so a potter makes a vase. The potter is the efficient cause, brings the vase about. The final cause of the vase is, well, its purpose, to hold flowers or something like that, right? Then you have two internal causes, the material and the formal cause. The material cause is the stuff out of which something is made. So if you're looking at the vase, it would be the clay, it would be the material cause. And the formal cause is what makes it to be the particular thing it is. For the pottery, it would probably be its shape that makes it to be what it is. So it would be the shape of the vase that makes it to be a vase. So for the vase, you could say efficient cause, potter, final cause, to hold flowers, material cause, clay, formal cause is its shape. So we're going to look at causal necessity for the will. So if we're saying the will is free, in some sense we're saying it's not necessary as far as Aquinas is concerned, despite what the compatibilists say, right? So I have material cause in red there because that's not going to be relevant to our concerns. Okay? So material cause of acts of the will is just going to be the power of the will, and that's not going to be important for looking at necessity in the will. So ultimately we want to look at the other three causes. So first of these is the efficient cause, and Aquinas talks about there can be necessity in efficient cause, and he gives this the name of coercion. So again, if you were dragged here tonight, that would be an instance of coercion, which means there's some efficient cause, the person who dragged you here, that brought about your bringing in this room tonight, right? So is this something that we can find in acts of the will? Well, Aquinas says When we speak of acts of the will, we can talk about external acts of the will and internal acts of the will. Internal acts of the will are things like choosing. You make a choice. External act is the thing that you choose. So if you chose to come here tonight, that's the internal act. You're actually moving your body to come here is the external act. Is that an act of the will? Well, it's an act of the body, but insofar as with your will you moved yourself to come here, he says it's also can be described as an act of the will. So with regard to this external acts, he says, yes, there can be coercion. There can be efficient cause making necessity here. As if you were dragged here tonight, then in fact that external act would not have arisen from your will, but from something else, and there would be coercion. But for acts of the will as internal acts of the will, he says, in no way can there be any coercion for internal acts of the will. Why? Well, it's a definitional thing for him. He says, a coerced act is from an external efficient cause, right? So it's from that person who dragged you here tonight. That's the external efficient cause. But the internal act of the will is an act of what? An appetite. What was an appetite, remember? It was an inherent movement to some end arising from knowledge. So the very notion of an act of the will is to be arising from within, and therefore there can be no coercion involved with that. How about final cause? Can there be any necessity in final cause? Well, he says, yes, there can be for the will. He calls this hypothetical or conditional necessity. He says, if you desire an end, and there's only one way to get it, then you hypothetically necessarily desire the means. His example, which no longer applies today, if you desire to cross the sea, then necessarily you desire to get on a ship. Now you can get on a plane, I suppose, right? But if you desire to go to the moon, I suppose you could say, then necessarily you desire to get on a rocket at any rate. But if there's only one way to attain it, then you can have necessity. Formal cause. This is called absolute necessity when we have formal cause, as far as Aquinas is concerned. This is found in a cause necessarily be determined to some effect, which remember, the determinist said every cause is necessarily determined to some effect. And Aquinas says, well, yeah, there are causes necessarily determined to their effect because, and it's formal cause because it's what makes it to be this kind of cause. So gravitational force is a necessary cause that involves formal cause by the nature of mass, right? This kind of absolute necessity comes into play. Interestingly, he says the will does have a formal absolute necessity associated with it. And this is what kind of distinguishes Aquinas from contemporary libertarian views that will deny this. He says, the will does have one goal that it's necessarily determined to. It has one goal that it's necessarily determined to, namely, the overall good. So in everything you do, you seek in some way what is your good. You seek your overall good in some way or other. And this is absolutely necessary. There's no way to avoid it, right? So in the will, there is some necessity as far as Aquinas is concerned, and a pretty important necessity. But, he says, when it comes to particular ways of achieving that, unless there is the final causal necessity of hypothetical necessity, you are not determined. So you want your overall good. Does that mean coming here tonight and finding out about free will? Well, not necessarily. You make that determination for yourself. You don't determine whether or not you're going to pursue the good, but you do determine yourself to particular goods to achieve your overall good. All right, we want to look at what Aquinas says about certain causes of the acts of the will. So the act of the will, I'll hurry up here. I'm going late. All right, so the act of the will is moved by reason. And this is the case because reason figures out what is good and worth pursuing. Remember, an appetite is a movement to an end following upon some awareness. Well, reason figures out what's good and worth pursuing. So reason moves the will, but it moves it as a kind of final cause, not as an efficient cause. I'm going to skip this. So it presents the object of desire and moves by final cause. Does the intellect determine the will to act? If it did, then this would lead to a kind of compatibilism. Again, Aquinas says the will is determined only with regard to the overall good, not with regard to particular goods. He also says the will itself is the cause of its own acts, or can be the cause of its act. The will moves itself to its own act. It doesn't make itself a kind of incoherent circular cause because, he says, ultimately, one act of the will causes another act of the will. By desiring an end, you move yourself to desire the means. So you may have wanted to learn about things, and one means to do so is coming here tonight. And so you, by the desire for the end of learning, you move yourself to the particular action of coming here tonight. So you don't get a kind of incoherent circular causality involved here, but one action causing another action. Ultimately, choice is not an uncaused action, as the determinists define it, but it is caused by the will itself, and that's this self-determination, right? Just a note on Aquinas and Benjamin Libet, a review of Libet. He expected to find the awareness of intention, the readiness potential, and the actual movement. In fact, he found the readiness potential and the awareness of intention and the actual movement. Aquinas might actually not be too troubled by the actual movement that Libet found, because he says, before there is any act of will, there has to be some awareness. Remember, an appetite follows upon awareness. And in order for there to be awareness, there has to be some brain activity. So he wouldn't be surprised that there has to be some brain activity preceding the intention to do something. But the question is, does this brain activity necessitate it? And again, the problem with Libet's experiments of the first one, they'd already decided when they feel the urge, they're going to clench their fist. The second one, experiment that he did, they could veto it. And Aquinas would say, yeah, they're not necessitated to do so. Yes, there might be a readiness potential because reason has to present something worth choosing, but ultimately the choice does depend upon the person himself, and that's this notion of vetoing.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.